The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again in what has been a fun week. A comic novel by Howard Jacobson brought a smile to almost every face when it won the Man Booker Prize. The rhapsodic Patrick Barkham brings out a book on his passion for butterflies. He meets a naturalist of gravitas, Richard Mabey, who publishes his thoughts on weeds. And Prince Charles has got together with the grizzled green campaigner Tony Juniper to pen a panegyric entitled Harmony. So let's first catch up on that Booker surprise.
The book we've chosen as our winner is one in which the depth of human understanding and lightness of touch combine in beautiful and compelling ways. It is all that it seems, and always more than it seems. Plangent, forthright, but subtle. Melancholy and funny. Ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the 2010 Man Booker Prize is The Finkler Question by Howard Jacobson.
I've always wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to write. I've never thought I want to write to be given a prize. One prize is at school, the English Literature Prize and the What's It Prize. They're just prizes at school, encouragement prizes. There's something about prizes for writers that you just kind of think, that's not what I'm in it for. But they exist. Prizes have always gone on. They're hellish things if you don't win them. But the other thing that has to be said is they are increasingly important. Anything that encourages people to read them, encourages people to realise that there's life in them, that they're fun. I mean, there's a fallacy out there that literature is difficult to read and tripe is easy. It's not true. Have you ever tried wading through, you know, what passes as a bestseller? It's unbelievably difficult. Read me, it's a joy. I'm not difficult. I'm a doddle. You sail through. And that's true of 1,500 people in the Royal Festival Hall on Sunday night listened to the 6 Booker Prize people read. They were rapt. Entirely different writers with entirely different manners of delivery, all very good, and the readers were rapt. And I think that's terribly, terribly important, that there is still a prize for books which are proper books in an age when we are swimming in a sea of improper books.
That was the ebullient Howard Jacobson and, of course, the chair of the Man Booker judges this year, Andrew Motion. But the most controversial book of this week is, of course, Harmony. It's the most extensive summary yet of the philosophy of the Prince of Wales. It's a very handsome book, expensively produced and beautifully illustrated. It'll doubtless adorn many industrially produced coffee tables in the month to come. And it will, of course, enrage all the usual suspects with its condemnation of all the wrong turnings the Prince of Wales feels have been taken by the modern, mechanised Western world. There's also an audiobook. And here's a taste of what he has to say in his own words.
I began to realise that the great juggernaut of industrialisation relies upon a somewhat aberrant kind of language, a man-made one, which articulates a worldview that ignores nature's grammar. Much of the syntax of this synthetic language is out of synchrony with nature's patterns and proportions. And this is why it so often jars with the language of nature. This is why so many modernist buildings don't feel right to so many people, even though they may find them clever. Or perhaps why we feel uncomfortable with factory farming, even though it makes economic sense because it supplies such a lot of food at such low prices. Or why we feel something is missing from a form of medicine that treats the body like a machine and does not accommodate the needs of the mind or the spirit. I find, by contrast, that if people are encouraged to immerse themselves in nature's grammar and geometry, discovering how it works, how it controls life on earth, and how humanity has expressed it in so many great works of art and architecture, they are often led to acquire some remarkably deep philosophical insights into the meaning and purpose of nature, and into what it means to be aware and alive in this extraordinary universe.
These might be the Prince's words, but they're not strictly all his own work. With me in the studio to discuss the book is one of his two co-authors, Tony Juniper, who was director of Friends of the Earth for 18 years before his resignation 2 years ago to spend more time with rainforests. Since then, he stood as a Green Party candidate in the general election and is advisor for a number of outlets, including the Prince's own Rainforest Commission. Tony, welcome. Can you just, first of all, explain what co-author means in this context? Because it's all very much written in his voice, first person, yes. Isn't it?
Yes, it is written in the voice of the Prince of Wales, but this was very much a three-way collaboration between Ian Skelly, the other co-author, the Prince of Wales and myself, and a lot of iteration, going backwards and forwards, sharing notes, sharing drafts in order to produce what is the final book that you have there, which we're all very proud of, and I think all of us can feel as though we have full ownership of.
There must have been points of disagreement or points that had to be argued out.
I don't think there were points of disagreement. There were points where perhaps we would have had a slightly different emphasis and maybe gone into more depth in some subjects rather than others. But I think all of us came to this knowing that we were embarking on a pretty complicated and controversial project. But all of us in our different ways come to the table with similar conclusions. And so the industrial juggernaut that the Prince talks about is something that I was campaigning to influence for many years at Friends of the Earth and before.
Now, it seems to me that it works on a series of oppositions, and the big central opposition is between holistic and mechanistic. Can you explain to me what these concepts mean?
The central premise is that the crisis we faced in the world at the moment in terms of how we're looking at the future of the economy, the future of society, and also these big ecological questions of climate change, of resource depletion, of mass extinction, all of which are now closely documented by the science. The problem isn't an absence of technology or an absence of clever policy. When you look at the way these issues are debated right now, you're often left thinking, well, surely this is a choice between wind power or nuclear power, for example, when it comes to the climate change question. Actually, what the book says is that, you know, the technology is important, it's vital for the solution, but the thing that is really lacking at the moment is a worldview fit for purpose. We've become so disconnected from how the universe and our planet functions, that reconnecting with that is the first thing we need to do in order to be able to solve these big challenges. And so that's where we then talk about the grammar of harmony and how nature can teach us a great deal about how we could live better, and that this requires a holistic view of the world in order to grasp that, and how that holistic view has been replaced by a mechanistic, very specific view that's based upon only looking at one aspect of the challenge or the solution at any one moment.
Now, let's just talk about it in one particularly controversial context, medicine. He mentions particularly that the shortcomings of westernised medicine and does put the argument for homeopathy, which is particularly vilified at this moment in time.
Amongst many other approaches towards medicine, homeopathy is just one aspect. Osteopathy, acupuncture, many other approaches towards more holistic medicine, looking at the human as a whole being rather than simply a series of fragmented symptoms, and being able to improve healthcare through that route, and not for one second dismissing modern technology or modern medicine, but putting it as one of the tools in a box which is far bigger than simply that one approach.
Is that your view as well? You,
yes,
and Ian endorse that view. So you would both support homeopathy as a valuable therapy?
As one therapy amongst many others, and it doesn't do all the jobs. Nothing does all the jobs, which is why you need a holistic view, and which is why you need to look at all the different opportunities we have and not relying on one single worldview, which is based at the moment on empiricism and technology. This is the discourse that governs how we look at these things at the moment, whether it's medicine, architecture, engineering, climate change, or whatever else. And so we're not for one second saying that technology and science don't have a role. We're saying it's the worldview that frames them that needs to be looked at very carefully if we are to navigate these big challenges.
Mm-hmm. When I listened to the audio, I was very struck by the fact that Prince Charles used the word revolution, which for a prince, an heir apparent, just seems a really, really loaded big word to use.
It is. And if you get into the book and you realise the scale of mind shift that's being talked about here, I think the word revolution is well chosen, and the Prince uses it in relation to a sustainability revolution, looking at our relationship with the Earth in a way which changes quite fundamentally how we live in coexistence with the rest of nature, indeed the rest of creation, one might say. And the ideas are laid out very much in that spirit. It's an invitation to start looking at the world through fresh eyes, hence the subtitle, A New Way of Looking at Our World.
Mm. And there are points at which you sort of throw up your hands, aren't there? Like, for example, on population. I mean, it specifically says that with the growth of the population we're having at the moment, we cannot have this vision. It would not work. So we have to do something about world population.
No, what it says is business as usual is unviable with the population growth that's built into the system. We're already over the edge in terms of damage to the ecosystem base, whether it's freshwater or fisheries or forests, over the edge in terms of global warming. Those trends are getting worse. If you add to that not only population growth, but the idea that all of us can live like Westerners, which is exactly where political thinking and cultural thinking is going at the global level, the arithmetic simply does not fit. It's not a council of doom in any respect, this book. We do move on to what the solutions look like, but we go beyond the technological solutions of how you can use renewable energy or biofuels or all these other things that are on the table. And we talk about the solution very much in terms of a different kind of philosophy, a different kind of worldview, a different way of looking at our relationships with nature. And we base that on what we call the grammar of harmony. Mm. So looking to nature for inspiration rather than simply fragmented mechanistic science.
You say we cannot make the equation balance unless we seriously address how we stabilize and even reduce the human population of the world. But it doesn't offer any way of doing that.
Well, one of the things we talk about in here, and population experts would talk about this too, is the extent to which sustainable development ultimately is the solution to population, i.e. giving people a decent life where they don't feel as though their future is in jeopardy and that they're going to be living in poverty, helping women in particular have access to education. All of these things are ultimately what has stabilised population growth historically and will be the kind of things that will stabilise population growth in the future. The question is, how do we achieve sustainable development? And this is where we challenge people to think about going beyond consumerism and narrow calculations of economic growth to be thinking about human well-being and how we can cooperate more effectively rather than competing as we do at the moment. You are, I think, you know, in difficult territory if you're arguing that we can carry on as normal and everything will be all right if only we can kickstart some more economic growth, which is pretty much where the political discussion is at the moment. And so we're challenging people to think beyond that.
There's one particular bit about Mumbai and a community of slum dwellers in Mumbai, yes, who've managed to create a society out of nothing, really.
Yes.
There's also a romance of indigenous peoples, isn't there?
Yes. It's not so much a romance. What we're doing in here is trying to identify in a grounded way how ideas that are close to this notion of harmony still actually exist in the world. And they have managed to hang on to their way of life and their worldview in some places. And we celebrate that in the book as being a source of inspiration for the rest of the world. And one of the things we talk about is the fact that in many parts of the Amazon basin where the rainforests are left, it's because the indigenous people have control, and it's not because they have a particular economic or particular legal control of the forest. It's because they have a different worldview and see themselves very much still connected with nature and it being part of their duty to hand nature on to the next generation. And so that worldview of the indigenous people is so powerful and such a contrast to the West that it's something that we felt we needed to flag up in the book as being something where you can still see echoes of humanity's past and which we need to get back, we argue, or at least to re-recognise as part of the way in which we bring about the sustainable future that we know we have to bring about.
But most of the world's population live increasingly in cities, don't they? And how does the experience of somebody in the rainforest, in however much logging's been done, there's still a lot of space and a lot of forest, relate to slum dwellers in Mumbai?
The point we're making there is how human capital is neglected in how we presently do quite a number of things, including how we design cities. And so what we're doing there is describing how out of apparent chaos and without any master planning and without any government handing down diktats of city street designs, people have created a thriving community out of nothing. What we're saying is if you put the design of communities into the hands of people, you can get much more harmonious conditions emerging than if you put it in the hands of town planners whose principal aim in life is to develop economic growth.
Now, I want to bring you back to this notion of harmony. And yes, there's a lovely picture of the carpet garden at Highgrove, which is actually rather touchingly based on the Quran, ideas, yes, of gardens in the Quran. But I hear the Prince of Wales's voice here, is particularly agitated about modernism. I don't quite understand why modernism is such an enemy.
The notion of the grammar of harmony that we describe in the book takes readers back to a period when the philosophies of the major faiths, including that of Islam and Christianity, were much more based around an understanding of the universe and the world inspired by nature. And so if you look at the designs that, for example, appear in Gothic cathedrals or in mosques built in the medieval period and before, you find that they are using an understanding of the world that was based upon geometry that you find in flowers, in the way in which the solar system works, and as we now know with modern technology, the structure of DNA. There are recurring patterns that are there in nature that were understood by these ancient civilizations that were passed on to the great faiths and which then inspired the way in which they looked at the world. And this is the connection with architecture in some ways, is seeing nature as an inspiration for this rather than mechanistic, modernistic thinking, which excludes nature deliberately in order to shock and to provoke people. So this is not simply a matter of taste that's being put across here, not liking modernist buildings and liking older buildings. This is about the history of ideas and how ideas in the past were much closer to nature and how that was reflected in a whole range of different disciplines and the way people thought, including in architecture.
So counterposed against this, all this technological and scientific development, you have this concept, the golden thread of wisdom.
Yes.
The rhetoric there, I'm interested in the rhetoric. It's very princely.
Well, he is the Prince of Wales, and so and he's helped to write this book very as the lead author. So the words and the voice is his throughout, and Ian and I have contributed ideas and obviously helped to do the writing and to help shape the final manuscript that's there in the book. But this is very much the Prince of Wales speaking, and he's found a voice here that I hope will carry far and wide. And, you know, if anybody is looking for a role for the future monarch, I think, you know, solving these big long-term problems, or at least laying out some opportunity for people to debate these big long-term problems outside the normal envelope, I think this is a fantastic contribution that we've got here in this book.
Tony Juniper, co-author with Ian Skelly and, of course, Prince Charles, of the new book, Harmony. It will, as intended, cause controversy, but Charles's answer is perhaps to be found in one of his favourite quotations from Mahatma Gandhi. First they laugh at you, then they ignore you, then they fight you, then you win. So let's now stay with our theme of living better with nature and go out into the countryside. Our own writer, Patrick Barkham, has fulfilled a lifelong dream and tracked down every surviving type of British butterfly. He describes this summer-long quest in his book, The Butterfly Isles, A Summer in Search of Our Emperors and Admirals. In the very same week, the veteran naturalist Richard Mabey has turned his penetrating gaze to weeds. So we brought them together in the Suffolk countryside near Richard's home.
So Richard, where are we here? It's a very sort of gloomy day, but we're on the strip of a lovely common full of dog walkers.
It's called Wortham Ling in the Waveney Valley. It's about 250 acres of common land. It used to actually be a fen, but about 150 years ago, all the peat that was on the top of it had actually been exhausted by cold Waveney Valley villagers for use in their fires. And it was taken right down to this almost pure sand substrate.
Well, we've already spotted our first weed of the day. I don't know what this is, but it's a brilliant sort of pale purple flowering plant, and
it's quite extraordinary. It's a musk mallow. It's quite bizarre to see it on here. Normally in full bloom, sort of late July, August. On this place, anything that appears above ground is normally eaten to shreds by rabbits in a few days. So, but in the strict sense of the word, I suppose this is a weed, because this place is defined as being low vegetation, chalk heath.
So is it correct to say that a weed is simply anything that is out of place, that is in a habitat where it shouldn't be?
I don't think it's as simple as that. I mean, I think that's a very good first start, but it's much more a case of weeds being in the wrong culture or territory, because quite often plants are growing precisely where they should be, but the human being's perception of what should be the vegetation is quite different. So ash trees are called weed trees, even when they're growing in the perfect conditions for them, let's say in a temperate woodland. But if it happens to be a woodland that foresters are trying to make oak woodland or beech woodland, then ashes are quite openly called weed trees.
Because we've got a very conflictual relationship with weeds, haven't we? And you explore this beautifully in your book, and all the incredible paradoxes really about weeds. And you make the point that actually, as sort of adaptive, unfussy generalists, weeds are in fact the thing that they resemble more than anything is, of course, ourselves.
Yes.
And that weeds ultimately are our most successful cultivated plant.
Yeah. It's the thing we don't tax ourselves with enough, the fact that we cause and create weeds. We didn't just name them, we actually provide the conditions for them to flourish in. So often we kind of get carried away and blame the plants themselves as if they were in some way immoral plants, as well as just being opportunist, adaptive generalists. If at the end of the day we want to reach a modus vivendi with weeds, but we sure aren't winning a battle against them, nor ever will, then the thing to do is to understand that we in effect cultivate them. We wreck the soil, and if one was to reach not that kind of cultural definition of weeds, which is a plant in the wrong place, but a kind of ecological definition of a weed, it is a plant which flourishes in disturbance, which grows fast, can tolerate all kinds of different environmental conditions, different weather conditions, is very mobile, and all these things give it the power to vegetate over very quickly areas of gross disturbance. In nature, a lot of weeds began in places like the scree slopes, unstable scree slopes of mountains, or
volcanoes,
at the foot of volcanoes, on seashores.
Most of the common here is incredibly disturbed ground. As you've said, it's been dug over, peat's been extracted,
it's been
presumably hugely overgrazed at times in the past. And
It wasn't messed around with.
So
it wasn't grazed that much. I mean, I know quite a lot of people whose families have lived on this common for generations, and the locals dug for sand and gravel. So there are lots of little depressions around the common where that happened. We're just coming across odd little stuff. This is a nightshade thing.
Lovely, delicate white flowers, hasn't it? And to me, its leaves look almost a bit like a young potato plant.
Yeah, well, potatoes is nightshade family, of course.
Mm. And that must have been resistant to rabbits, because like the other weed we saw, this has grown up higher above
that's very
closely cropped sward here.
Yeah, rabbits don't eat nightshades very much. I mean, I think they must be able to smell the alkaloids or
something. Richard, can I ask you about this one? Is this ragwort?
Yeah, sure.
And now ragwort crops up a lot in your account of the life of weeds, and it's incredibly powerful thing. But one of the things that really interested me was you wrote about how horses and farm livestock can eat ragwort and be poisoned and die.
Today, I mean, it's regarded with almost indescribable venom by farmers.
There's a particular law, isn't there? A law is passed just for ragwort.
Yeah, there is a Ragwort Control Act, and one's supposed to pull it out of one's land.
But what does ragwort look like when it's fully grown?
Well, it's a member of the daisy family, has these rather kind of crisp, indented leaves, and puts out a really quite a large number of little yellow daisy-like flowers at the top of its stems.
Now, if it was a sunny day, and maybe if we were a couple of months earlier as well, the fully grown yellow ragwort, I always associate it with cinnabar moths,
who seem
to adore it. And as you write in Weeds, and as I know from my experience writing the Butterfly Isles, there's one thing that butterflies and moths alike adore, and that's what we would call weeds, isn't it? Food plants for everything from the banks of nettles at the bottom of our garden that small tortoiseshells and peacocks lay on, to birdsfoot trefoil, to all the different ranges of wild grasses that the skipper family of butterflies adore. Nothing's better. Butterflies don't thrive in cultivated areas in the same way. And, of course, the butterfly bush that is most beloved of butterflies is the buddleia, which, as you describe, you've seen growing three stories up in Bristol, off buildings, haven't you? Yeah. And weeds are the best thing for insect life, aren't they?
But here's another thought, and tell me what you think of this, Patrick. I mean, one of the reasons that ragwort may be more of a problem now, if that's what it is there may be very much more of it, because the cinnabar moth caterpillars, which were one type of natural control over it, are now much scarcer. I mean, my wholly subjective register is that they are very much scarcer now, along with enormous numbers of species of moth. Would that be your...
I certainly feel that subjectively, and certainly my memories of the 1980s were of seeing cinnabar moths absolutely everywhere, and I certainly see fewer now. There's a very interesting experiment in the, I think it was in the 1930s, where butterfly breeders and moth breeders in Britain actually bred and shipped over more than 60,000 cinnabar moths to New Zealand, where they had a terrible problem with ragwort as an introduced species and decimating the landscape. And they hope to control the ragwort through the cinnabar moth, classic example of a sort of biological control, and I don't think it worked well.
No. They quite often do.
One of the problems, I guess, with our globalised world and the fact that we're now moving weeds around the world, so inadvertently, of course, but in things like fertilisers and imported plants and in all kinds of ways, even in the turnips of our trousers, as you noted. And one of the problems is that we don't bring the insects with them. So Japanese knotweed thrives, doesn't it? Because in Japan, there's a psyllid, a form of insect that keeps it, sort of is a restraint on it. And in Britain, well, we've just got the psyllid now because it's one of our first biological controls, isn't it?
Undergoing trials at the moment,
And I guess one of my issues with weeds is I feel like we are learning in Britain to love what we think of as British weeds, even if, as you show, a lot of what we think of as British weeds have only been here for a couple of hundred years. But in my eyes, I love the weeds that help our domestic butterflies. But something like Japanese knotweed, I've never seen a butterfly nectaring on Japanese knotweed.
Oh, I have.
Have you?
Yes,
have you?
Yes,
oh,
yes,
really?
Yes,
have
yes.
you? Oh, well, that's that's hopeful.
But no, I mean, the point you make about sort of distinguishing between weeds which have more or less, I mean, I sort of use this concept of naturalisation, which have either indigenous or more or less fit into the ecosystem generally. I mean, they are different from big, extremely distant newcomers that have no kind of engagement with the existing ecologies, either in terms of the sort of chemical messages that they exchange with native plants, or, as you say, with the predatory things that eat their leaves and flowers. And so they can ramp away in a quite destructive way.
How do we have to retrain ourselves to look at weeds and to look at wild places?
I think to be curious about why they're there. It's to do with soils and weather and history. And simply to ask that question unreels an extraordinary tangle of stories about plants' origins, and it will be about the history of the soil, about the history of the human use of it. It will be about the fit between that particular weed's reproductive mechanisms and the way the land has been used, and suddenly they cease to be this kind of arbitrary invader, which I think is the knee-jerk reflex we have at the moment. Weeds, damn the things, they come in. And I think as soon as you ask, well, why are they there? They become actually real organisms again. And if you have to make a judgment about their continued existence, I mean, it is informed, at least, by this new sympathy, perhaps, with them. One of the things, Patrick, that's been evident this autumn is that in response to really quite unusually dismal weather, in which there's been a lot of rain and not very high temperatures, is that flowering has pretty much stopped. I've barely seen a vanessid butterfly, the Red Admiral's tortoiseshell peacock group, for the last month.
I saw a Red Admiral 2 days ago in pouring rain, sort of darting along a street, and it was looking a bit like a cat burglar, sort of approaching every window, desperately trying to get in, and I was sort of watching it, praying for it, that thinking of every droplet of rain falling on its small body and just thinking, I hope it gets inside in time, but it's certainly been slightly miserable. You know, we sometimes get these wonderful Indian summers, don't we? And last year actually was a case in point, and I saw dozens and dozens of small coppers at this time last year, which can have this sort of third brood late on, and I saw a Queen of Spain fritillaries as well, which is a very rare migrant, but and again with the sort of fine autumn, they'd successfully managed to pass through a kind of an extra cycle of their life and hatch out as adult butterflies, and we're sort of enjoying that wonderful mellow October sunshine that we get. But
is it that they're not about, or they're just lying low?
Well, I think they're safely tucked up. They're incredibly hardy creatures in many respects. And, of course, the six that can hibernate through our winters are absolutely adapted for this kind of thing. And as long as they've shut themselves away and have found a good log pile or a good garden shed, they should be fine. And it's actually harsh winters that they like. Although, having said that, what they don't really like is this kind of weather where it's warm and wet, because, of course, if these hibernating butterflies are then woken halfway through their hibernation and are sufficiently energised to come out and fly around, and there's no flowers for them to nectar on, then there's a bit of a problem.
Ideally, of course, I mean, to join our two worlds, the great nectar source in most areas at this moment in the year is ivy.
And you get that wonderful sort of sickly smell as you go past it. And I just associate this time of year absolutely with red admirals in orchards feasting on rotten apples or on that ivy on a wall. I mean, the one thing that is certain is that our 59 species, there are only 59 resident species really in Britain compared to 400 or so in Europe, and it's a legacy of our northerly position, but also the fact that we're an island. But the 59 that are here are supremely well adapted to our weather. So if there's one thing we don't really need to worry about, it's the weather. But of course, as conservationists point out, when butterfly numbers get so low that they're down to sort of hundreds in certain sites, it could be that a really dismal autumn or terrible storms in midsummer does sort of wipe out vulnerable populations. But and certainly this summer, the rains in July wiped out an excellent crop, if you like, of purple emperors in our woodlands, which had done tremendously well the previous summer and had just emerged and were flying around looking for mates. And we had a sort of switch in southern England, didn't we, where the jet stream diverted. And that was bad news for our purple emperors this year. But they're such clever, you know, adaptive creatures, and I'm sure many of them will perhaps shift their life cycle slightly. And perhaps if we start getting a regular kind of July-style monsoon, perhaps butterflies will be able to fit their life cycles around that.
And their habitat preferences. I mean, in your book, you mention, you know, a number of cases of butterflies that have suddenly changed their preferences for habitat.
In the space of 50 generations, in just 50 years, they can change, like the Duke of Burgundy, from being a woodland butterfly to actually surviving on overgrown grassland rather than woodland which was no longer suitable to it. Whilst I sort of fear for some of our butterflies and tend to get into this sort of sentimental, slightly romantic feeling that this beauty is so ephemeral that it must therefore be fragile, actually they're probably not so fragile, they're probably as tough as some of our weeds.
And our producer says that the two of them were having such a nice time chatting away that they just went on and on until it was time to go home for tea. Patrick Barkham's The Butterfly Isles is published by Granta. Richard Mabey's Weeds, How Vagabond Plants Gatecrashed Civilization and Changed the Way We Think About Nature is published by Profile. And that's it for this week's podcast. Join us next week for the lowdown on the Royal Society Prize for Science books. Meanwhile, Saturday's Guardian Review has the new Booker Laureate Howard Jacobson on the artist Stanley Spencer. The Observer's new review on Sunday will carry an extract from Simon Garfield's new book about printers' fonts, Just My Type, and look out for our short film about it on the website. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.